Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
And this week, we'll also be hearing from writer-director Ava DuVernay, who's talking about her new film, Origin, and director Juan Carlos Fresnadillo, who will be talking about his new film, Damsel, which stars Millie Bobby Brown and a big dragon. We'll also be reviewing those films, as well as Copa 71 and the re-release of Pixar animation Soul. But first, James, have you been watching anything else or been up to anything exciting this week?
Since I last spoke to you, I was at the Berlin Film Festival, so I came back about a week or so ago. My outstanding film there, which actually premiered in Sundance but then played in Berlin, was Love Lies Bleeding.
Oh, wow.
You obviously have a feature in the current magazine as well on. And this is Kristen Stewart starring in a kind of lesbian crime movie. Set in the late 80s. It's directed by Rose Glass, who did St. Maud, which was an extremely promising film. And I think she absolutely knocks it out of the park with Love Lies Bleeding. I absolutely love that film. It's one of those that when I saw it, I couldn't stop talking about it to people. Amazing. It just blew everything else out of the water that I saw at that festival. So yeah, that was fantastic. That's out in May in the UK. So everyone has to go and see that. It's a brilliant piece of work.
I can't wait to see that because I love St. Maud and love the sound of this one. So yeah, I'm definitely up for seeing that. And I, to be honest, I haven't really been watching much this week besides the films we're going to be talking about. The only thing I have started watching, I don't know if you ever watched this, James, it's a couple of years old now, but basically I like to have something to watch to unwind before I go to bed of an evening. And I struggle to stay awake a lot of the time these days if I'm watching anything too late. But there was this BBC series called Cheaters a couple of years ago. It dropped, I think, starring Susan Wacoma. And it's sort of like a little comedy drama, but the episodes are 10 minutes long and that stuck in my mind and I'd never seen it. And so I just needed something short to start watching recently. And so I just started that. I'm quite enjoying it, actually. I'm about halfway through. Just really nice to have 10 minute episodes, to be honest. So at the end of the day, there's always time to just shove one on. So that's what I've been kind of getting into.
I'm assuming it's not about the jungle animal.
No, it's about infidelity and the kind of premises. These two people meet while they're in Finland. She's there for work. He's there. I can't remember if he's there for fun or not. But yeah, they're both there in the same hotel. Basically end up sleeping together after sort of sharing some drinks. And then they come home and discover they actually live across the road from each other. And that's the kind of premise. So it's very heightened. It's kind of funny, but sort of dramatic as well. And yeah, I've just been enjoying that really. But it's a couple of years old, but it's still hanging around on iPlayer. So that's what I've been watching this week.
Well, the other thing I did actually revisit this weekend at the cinema was Perfect Days, the Wim Wenders film, which came out also a week or so ago. And I saw that just before Cannes last year and really enjoyed revisiting that. That's just one of his best films in about 30 years, his best narrative films anyway, all set in Tokyo, all about a toilet cleaner who has a very simplistic, ritualistic life. And which doesn't sound like a great sell when I say it's about a toilet cleaner, but I promise you, if you haven't seen it, go and see it. It's a beautiful film.
I'm absolutely desperate to see it. I still haven't caught it yet, but it's like everything I've read and heard about it, I just know I'm going to really like it. So that's very much on my list to catch soon. Yeah, so we go on to new releases now. And first up, we're grappling with some extremely weighty subject matter with this.
Most relationships end. Friendships, romances, they break. You okay? If you look closely, you'll find something tragic was happening.
This is Origin, the latest film from writer-director Ava DuVernay, best known for her Martin Luther King Jr. movie Selma, which was nominated for the Best Picture Oscar. Origin is inspired by the non-fiction book Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson. But rather than being a straightforward adaptation of this non-fiction book, the film is kind of the story of Wilkerson, played here by Ingenue Ellis-Taylor. And it also weaves in themes from the book, which is exploring racism in the US in relation to caste systems from around the world and across history. But before we review the film, let's hear what Ava had to say when you caught up with her last week.
I want to be in the story. Really inside the story. And build a thesis that shows how all of this is linked.
I gotta be honest with you, I don't understand. I don't see it.
You go and write your stories. Folks need to know about this.
First of all, perhaps just tell me how you first encountered Isabel's book and what sort of impact did it make on you when you first read it?
The book was being passed around. It was a book that was being widely read in the summer of 2020. This is the first summer of the pandemic and the summer of the murder of George Floyd. I read the book and, you know, was deeply moved by it, largely by the introduction of caste as a contemporary idea that affected my own life. Up until then, I had regarded caste as a kind of a anthropological phenomenon that happened in India, and really had never considered it as a component of the way that I organized my own thoughts about my identity and my place in the world. And so that was compelling to me, and read it a couple of more times, and then approached the writer Isabel Wilkerson about adapting it.
How difficult, though, is it to adapt a book like this? I mean, fascinating thesis that it's sort of at its core, but to try and turn that into a narrative feature, how tricky was that?
It was tricky, pretty tricky. But you creatively attack these issues and you dive in and you make it work. And it was a joy to try to excavate and find a way into this material.
So how did you approach it in terms of integrating elements of Isabel's life into the story?
The film is basically a biography of a book. It's about the life and work of Isabel Wilkerson as she writes the book Caste. And so, you know, instead of trying to write a film about caste, which is a pretty lofty goal, I tried to write a film about a woman who was on a journey, an intellectual and emotional journey. And that journey involved writing this book. And by doing that, it allowed me to enter in from a character perspective, which is what I do. I write films and television shows about people and their motivations, and allowed me to kind of take the pressure off of writing a movie about this big, unruly topic. You know, I don't know if I'm smart enough or well-researched enough, or I have all the things that I need to write a movie about caste, but I can write a movie about a woman writing a book about caste. And so that allowed me to have the distance from the topic and the proximity to the character and to find my way through the screenwriting process.
And you said you sort of met Isabel early on in the process. I mean, did you kind of interview her to talk to her about her life as she was writing this book? Did she help you in that capacity, or did she sort of stay away from the project once you started writing?
Yes, I had the opportunity to interview her over the course of about 2 years. This is during the pandemic, so primarily Zoom, but we did meet a couple of times. And these are hours-long interviews that really allowed me to understand her process as a creative, as an intellectual, and then also, you know, her personal journey and what she was enduring in terms of the loves and losses in her life. She was very gracious and very generous and opening herself up to the process in that way. And I'm very grateful to her.
Now, you mentioned that the book kind of bowed in 2020. I think it was a couple of months after the shooting of George Floyd. I mean, obviously, Isabel would have been researching this book long, long before that happened, clearly. But how significant do you think it was that it came out during this turbulent period of American modern history?
Very significant. The book is bookended by two very, tragic moments in American history as it relates to the murder, violence, and aggression of Black people by the dominant culture, dominant caste. She began this, part of the impetus of this book for her, as she described it, was the verdict in the Trayvon Martin case, which is explored in the film. And so that basically starts her journey. And the film is published the summer of the murder of George Floyd, which ends the journey. And so I think that book ending is very telling.
You said that when you first read the book, the idea of the caste system was something that you associated with what happens in India. And I'm sure that's what most people from the West who pick up this book would think. So what kind of a learning experience was it for you, first of all, reading the book and then making the film, learning deeply about the caste system and how it relates to, well, whether it's, as you show in the film, whether it's kind of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust or what's happened in America. I mean, it must have been an incredible learning curve that you went on.
Yeah, it was an incredible experience. I mean, when you read a book that's introducing, you know, ideas that allow you to, you know, change the direction of your thinking or re-examine or interrogate what your belief system might be, it's always, you know, well, for me, quite exhilarating. And so, you know, to take that from the book through the process of making the film was a thrilling experience and one that was revelatory and that I enjoyed quite a bit.
I mean, it's also an incredible journey that the film, well, certainly that the film takes the audience on in terms of the countries it goes to, but that must have been the same for you as well. I mean, whether you're shooting in Germany or India, so perhaps you could describe what the experience of actually making this movie was like.
Sure. We shot the film in 37 days across three continents as an independent production. This was not made with a studio. This is made by my African-American-owned, self-motivated production company. And we got out there into the world. We shot it in the United States and several states, in Berlin, in Delhi. The film crosses seven different time periods, over 400 years. And, you know, was an extraordinary production journey. And I think an example of what's possible as independent filmmakers, both in its scope and scale as an international production and in its the intimacy of being a very homegrown production by a singular production company outside of the studio system.
Do you feel like it was one of the toughest films you've made, just in terms of what you've just described, the logistics of the production?
No, not tough. My word would be joyous. It was fantastic. Everything that I'd done up until that point had prepared me and my production company to be able to know exactly how to make this film. So, you know, we've made over eight series for American television, you know, one of which lasted seven seasons. We've shot internationally for, you know, a film that I made for Disney called A Wrinkle in Time. I'd shot with, you know, large ensemble casts of over 150 people. I'd done period pieces. I'd done huge set pieces. I'd done VFX. You know, over the past 10 years of my career, I touched on and honed, you know, the skills to be able to make this picture confidently. And so I would say, truly, it was probably one of the easier projects that I'd worked on and certainly the most joyous.
Did you try and get it made through the studio system, or do you think it's still a type of film that the studio still wouldn't go near?
No, we didn't try to make the film through the studio system. It was initially set up with Netflix. Netflix wanted to make the film this year. I wanted to make it last year. So this time last year, we were wrapping production, and now we're opening on March 8th in the UK. We would have just been going into production right now, and I did not want to wait that long. So instead of leaving Netflix and going into the studio system, we decided to raise the money on our own and make it on our own. We raised the money and within 6 months, and we were shooting the film over the 37 days and on to post and debuted at Venice in 2023.
Yeah, I was there in Venice actually when the film did debut. What sort of reaction did you get playing it at the festival, first of all, and since then, at other festivals you might have been at or just generally screenings, what sort of feedback are you getting from audiences?
Extraordinary feedback. You know, the 9-minute standing ovation at Venice was proper feedback. And the subsequent standing O's in Toronto and the other festivals. But it's really beyond the standing ovations and the reviews and the awards is people who have seen the film in the United States who have then raised money for other people to see the film. So at the end of our film in the US, there's a QR code where people can put up their phones and buy a ticket for someone else for $16. That one-to-one ticket buy and the way that people are motivated to share the film after has raised over $500,000 for students and senior citizens to see the movie for free. And so that tells me that the film is resonating. It's had a small release in the United States. It'll have a small release in the UK. But when people do see the film, the reaction has been one that's been quite emotional, quite connected, and quite, you know, interested in sharing the films with others, which is you know, was one of our big goals. Let's connect on a human level and talk about the things that we don't often talk about in cinema.
Well, I have to say, I've never heard of that idea before, of a ticket sharing idea, but it's brilliant. How did that arise?
It was an idea that we had had that we put up a small website for. It's called Seat 16. And, you know, we knew that there were people out there who would not be able to afford the film or didn't have access to the film. And we also had seen on the festival circuit that people were deeply moved by the film. So the question was, if you've seen the film and you have the means to buy a ticket for someone else, could we set up a process by which you could buy a ticket for someone else? So it was really simple. We just put a QR code at the end of the movie. People hold up their phones. They tap a button and they buy a ticket. And then that ticket goes to the education department of Array, which is our nonprofit. And we connect those tickets to school districts and community groups and youth organizations around the country. And like I said, over $500,000, more than that, over $500,000 has been raised thus far. I mean, we're actually getting almost close to $1 million there. And that's through individual donors and people who want to share the movie. So when we talk about success, you know, I can say, yeah, it was the day that I stood in a gown and had a 9-minute ovation at Venice, or it's the day that this award came or that award came. But really, it is that. It is at the end of a film, you've had a film experience and you've been so moved by it, or you are so interested in the ideas in it that you buy a ticket for someone you don't know. That's the achievement that I'm the most proud of.
Well, yeah, that is a real achievement. Although I imagine one of the other gratifying elements in terms of going back to sort of festival screenings, let's say, and other kind of screenings that you might attend would be the Q&As afterwards, if you do one. I would imagine this is a film that inspires lively debate. Was that the case?
Oh, wow. The best. You're so right. You know, just hearing people talk afterward about it. I've started to do a thing at screenings where, you know, usually it's a Q&A. So there's a moderator and they're asking you questions, or you take questions from the audience. I've come to be so interested in what the audience is thinking that I don't want to hear myself talk anymore, that I start to ask the audience questions, and the answers and the associations and the memories and the statements have been so, you know, bold and brave and exhilarating. That, you know, I really love being in conversation with the audiences. I probably shouldn't say in conversation. I basically just start asking them questions and they start to converse with one another, and it just creates a really beautiful energy. And I always learn a lot. So, yeah, absolutely. That's one of the big, big pluses as well.
Any encounter that sticks out in your mind? Anyone that came up with some fascinating insight into the film?
Yeah, there was a young man, a young Black man in the United States who had talked about a connection between two scenes that I hadn't even seen. I mean, I wrote and I made this film, but he was talking about, and I don't want to give it away, but the connection between the Trayvon Martin character and a character that you meet towards the end of the film, a young boy who has an interaction at a public pool. And he had talked about, you know, the symmetry of some of the framing and how there were narrative connections that he made that were deeply emotional to him between those two scenes, you know, and something that is very much there. He saw it. And when he said it, I kind of gasped. I didn't realize that I had even done what he had seen. And so sometimes it takes people watching the work that have some distance from it to bring you as a filmmaker even closer to it. And so it's been a you know, many beautiful revelations like that.
Obviously, I can't talk to you about this film and not ask you about your leading lady. How did you set about casting Isabel?
Yeah, Anjanou Ellis-Taylor in what I think is a remarkable performance. You know, she was the only person who ever had an offer for the movie. I had worked with her before on a limited series I did called When They See Us for Netflix. She was part of a sprawling cast there, but I remember her determination and her the delicate way in which she goes about her work. And so, you know, the collaboration with her was a thrill. She's very muscular in her acting ability. She's a deep diver into the text and into the meaning, and she brings it all to the set every single day. And it was just a real ride with her. You know, it was a full course meal working with Anjanou Ellis-Taylor. And I'm just grateful to her for all she gave to the performance.
Did you guys ever wrestle, let's say, with certain ideas, or were you always on the same page?
And we were constantly wrestling with the ideas and trying to push them to a place where they were the most accessible to the widest group of people. And so we were, you know, always pushing one another. And, you know, that's really what I wanted and needed was an intellectual partner in the pursuit. You know, I wasn't interested in just giving an actor a script and saying, say those lines. You know, I wanted to kind of get into it and push and pull the material to get to a certain place. And she was the perfect partner for that.
I mean, there are so many incredible scenes that I could pick out in this film. I just wondered, when you have sequences set in 1930s Berlin and you're showing the Nazi insignia and everything that was, you know, you're recreating that moment in history. I wonder how, well, moving that was, first of all, and how in some ways must have been quite terrifying for you to kind of approach that part of the film.
No, not terrifying at all. Exhilarating to be able to have the permission of the Berlin, you know, city officials to actually, you know, stage that book burning scene in the actual square where the events took place, to be standing on the same cobblestone, to be able to study photographic evidence of the crime, of the burning of the books, and to reconceive those, restage those, reimagine them, and to put, you know, actual character and emotion to these still photographs, you know, was the opposite of intimidating or frightening. It was an honor. It was exhilarating. And it was an incredible couple of days filming there in Berlin.
Was it tough to get permission to film those scenes?
It wasn't easy. I wouldn't say that it was the hardest permissions that we had pursued or we've ever pursued as a company. I think our track record as producers, the way that we presented our plan, our safety plan, our production plan, but also the creative plan and what we wanted to say, you know, that we wanted to show what happened here and the goal of making sure it never happens again was well received. And we worked very well with the German officials.
So that was Ava DuVernay talking about Origin. James, what did you actually think of the film then?
Well, you sort of summed it up when you said it's about Wilkinson herself, you know, the author of this book. It's an extraordinarily difficult book to adapt because obviously it's a non-fiction book. It's a book about ideas. As you said, it's about the caste system in India and how that underpins kind of, well, it's linked in the book to, and in the film to, say, the rise of the Nazis and the Holocaust, and also what happened in America in the Deep South with slaves. So it's using the caste system and as a way in to talk about racism in various other countries. So to try and dramatize that is extremely difficult. So the idea of focusing on Wilkinson as she researches this book is a clever one. It brings a lot of her own personal life to the fore. So issues kind of with her husband, played by John Bernthal, issues with her mother as well. And some of those elements didn't work for me as well as the ideas in the film, because you also get flashbacks to, say, 1930s Berlin, where there's a couple of African-American anthropologists who are sort of in the library there. And then they're kind of bearing witness to this sort of rise of fascism, you know, in Germany. And you have scenes set in India with sort of these lower caste people, which are sort of beautifully made. And then right at the beginning of the film, you have an extract of the killing of Trayvon Martin, who was a young African-American who was killed by George Zimmerman. That happened in 2014. And that event sort of leads Wilkinson to sort of write this book. So it's almost a way to kickstart the book and sort of kickstart her journey. So, and then strangely, when the book was published in 2020, it was around the time, it was just after George Floyd's murder in the US. So there's a strange kind of bookend between the Trayvon Martin killing and the Floyd murder. It's encompassing, as you said right at the beginning, some real heavyweight topics. And to try and sort of build that into a narrative is extremely bold, really. You'd have to say that. It didn't entirely work for me. There were times when I felt like I was kind of being watching a lecture on some level, but I think that's kind of inevitable when you're dealing with these sort of topics. It could have been a sort of 10-part documentary or something. And I think that has been a sort of criticism levied at the film. But again, how many people would watch that? Would people watch that compared to watching a sort of 2-hour you know, narrative story about an author's journey. And I think what she does do quite well is avoid the cliches of an author sitting at the typewriter bashing it out. You know, really it's about her, you know, she does go to Germany, she does go to India in the contemporary years, as well as these flashbacks that I'm kind of referring to. You know, in a way, it's really not so much about the writing of the book, but about the researching of the book and the way these ideas suddenly kind of, these light bulb ideas go off in her head. And that, as I keep saying, that's really hard to dramatize. And I think Duvernay did a pretty good job of that, even if it doesn't quite entirely work for me. I mean, what did you make of it?
To be honest, I come from a very similar place, yeah, with you on it, really, in that didn't know a great deal about it. So I was coming to it fairly, you know, like fresh and open-minded. Yeah, so I didn't realize quite how they were tackling the book and exactly what it was going to cover. But yeah, there were definitely times where I felt like this feels like it would make a bit more sense as a documentary because of obviously some of the things that were being dealt with. And it's obviously, it's unusual the way it's done. But then there was part of me, I just couldn't basically help but admire the boldness of it, you know, and the kind of, you know, giving it a go in that sense. There were a few segments I did just find moving as well, like because of the nature of how the story's told and how we're following Wilkerson and then also seeing these past stories. Maybe each one never got quite enough momentum or quite enough sort of drama in the individual strands. But there were certainly some segments that I found very moving and really sort of stuck with me. Wilkerson kind of has a lot of sort of tragedy in her own life, which we, you know, we kind of see throughout. And then, yeah, then there's just some of the kind of stories you see are just, you know, you just kind of can't help but be moved by them.
There's one incredibly moving moment. I saw the film in Venice 6 months ago and then rewatched it, you know, very recently. And again, second time around, I was sort of moved by it, where you're introduced to these lower caste workers who are effectively forced to kind of clean out sewers, and their only sort of protection is kind of oiling each other's skin. You know, they're literally kind of, they're standing with just their heads above what is basically sort of pools of excrement. I mean, it's completely horrific. You see this kind of almost slow motion moment of one of them oiling up another one just to sort of protect his skin, and it's kind of cut to this beautiful music. And it's, I thought that was such a moving moment. And in a way, though, you're right, those segments don't really add up to anything huge, but some of them, like that, it's almost like little fragments of illustrate her points.
Yeah.
And some of those fragments work really, really well, some of them less so. But I was more interested in those than I was, to be honest, from her tragedy and her personal life. I mean, she does go through some terrible things, but I didn't find that as easy to engage with as the ideas, or I found the ideas more sort of gripping. I mean, there's one where they talk about how, I mean, this is quite a famous one from the book, I think, but how sort of lawyers in sort of Nazi Germany were looking at the Jim Crow laws in America, which was sort of laws about segregation, you know, were applied to the Deep South, and how they kind of saw how America had sort of segregated its population. And then they kind of used that for their own construction of the Nuremberg laws in terms of what they were basically doing in terms of the Holocaust. So it's fascinating to know that Nazi Germany was looking towards what America was doing with slavery, and that's recorded in history, but it's not well known. And again, I think that's one of Duvernay's kind of arguments, not to have a documentary, but to have it in a piece of popular entertainment, to try and convey a piece of information like that so that, you know, your general viewer who goes to see this film will be shocked, because most people won't know that piece of information now. And you know, there are moments like that that really do work very, very well.
And it certainly draws attention to the book as well. It makes you kind of come away thinking, like, you know, you want to kind of explore these stories in a bit more detail in the book. And again, maybe that was another aspect that didn't work quite so well for me towards the end. We get quite a lot of narration from Wilkerson, the character, especially towards the end. There's, like you say, it avoids the cliche of like sitting at the typewriter sort of hammering it out, but there is a bit of like drawing things on whiteboards and underlining them and kind of reading out the points, which again, it kind of feels like, you know, it's sort of a necessary means to kind of get this across, but perhaps doesn't feel as sort of smooth as it could have been. Or again, maybe you kind of very much feel that, like, right, this is how we're going to have to get around this, adapting this nonfiction book.
There has to be certain scenes, I guess, of her connecting the dots. But I felt it less cliched than certain films I've seen about writers, you know, hammering out a book or something. You know, it's a tricky one because it is a film about the process of creation on some level. So you have to have certain scenes to join up those dots. But yeah, I thought DuVernay pretty much avoided most of that cliche stuff that we see before.
Yeah, and there's lots of interesting little moments throughout as well. Like, I just to add to the kind of moving parts, there's a bit where we kind of see like this sort of little league baseball team, and there's like one black child on the team, and they kind of go to a swimming pool, and then the kind of obviously the issue of segregation comes up there, and there's like a kind of, you know, a whole sequence surrounding that, and I found that very sort of moving, and that really kind of stuck with me just again when it's sort of illustrating it on sort of such a personal level and with just, you know, such a young child as well. So yeah, so there was several things like that stuck with me. So yeah, I thought there was a lot interesting there, even if it didn't entirely hang together. Still felt like I was glad I saw it, you know, and took quite a lot away from it. So kind of interesting film.
Definitely.
So that is Origin. If you fancy seeing that, that's in cinemas now. Next up, we're heading from the real world to this fantasy realm.
We need this. Your people need you.
I need you to listen to me now. I don't trust them. They may be royalty, but that doesn't make them good people.
Your hand, child.
Close your eyes. I've got you.
This is Damsel, which stars Millie Bobby Brown as a young woman who, in a historical fantasy realm, is married off to a prince. But she doesn't just live happily ever after. As it turns out, he's intent on sacrificing her to a dragon to pay off his family's mysterious debt. Now, before me and James discuss this film, our deputy online editor, Faye Watson, recently sat down with Juan Carlos Resnadillo to discuss the film. And here's what they had to say.
It is this sacrifice we commemorate every generation, a tradition going back centuries. A legacy of honor and duty you now inherit.
I can imagine it takes a long time to come together, so it's nice to kind of get to this point where the world's about to see it.
Yes, especially, you know, thinking about the process of making this movie, it took me 5 years of my life since I decided to put my head on it until the release date. 5 intense years, to be completely honest with you. You know, after seeing the reaction in the premiere in New York last Friday and how people were kind of applauding, almost feeling shaking in their bodies in the seats while they were watching the movie, it was so amazing. What I could say, it was worth this kind of long journey because the movie's there and it's a pleasure to share.
And I guess Damsel, kind of the premise of it really inverts a lot of fairy tale tropes. Do you think that the kind of fantasy that we're used to seeing on screen was kind of overdue, that reinvention?
I think it's important, you know, at least for me, you know, as a filmmaker, you know, every time that I try to make a movie, I want to make something unique and fresh, something that you haven't seen before. And I was lucky when I read Damsel, because since you read the first page of this script, you notice that this is going to be different. This is going to be new. And also another great value that this story has from the script point of view is the fact that the flipping of this, the reinvention of the fairy tale, it's for the good of much better characters. You know, I got the impression that all these characters are real and they have a proper emotional journey. A journey also that reflects a much more modern and contemporary take on them. So in that way, you know, the storytelling is something that the audience is going to feel like a big surprise, which I'm excited for them to see and enjoy. And that's why I'm here. That's why I decided to make the movie.
And you've spoken about how amazed you were by Millie Bobby Brown's performance in this film. Kind of going in, were you a fan of Stranger Things? Is that what drew you to her?
I've been a fan of Millie for many years, you know, since I saw her in, you know, in the first episodes of Stranger Things. You know, that the first thing that I noticed when I saw that was she has a sparkling personality, you know, which is one of the things that you need to have if you want to become a star, a real actress, you have to have something that the audience cannot take your eyes off you, you know? And she had that for sure. But the amazing thing that I've been seeing with her as she's growing up in all her career is the fact that she's becoming a real profound actress, you know? And I noticed those values in the last works that she did. That's why we were so happy when she decided to come on board, because in some ways, this story is about a transformation of a young woman into a real independent woman, some kind of fighter that it's going to save for her, it's going to fight for herself, for her life. And Millie, you know, in the last year, has been dropping those kind of things in the works that she did. And I think it was time now to kind of gather all those kind of things that she's been doing and put it in one single movie. And that's why I think Damsel in some ways is almost like the perfect summary of all the capabilities that Millie has. And I think it shows to the audience that she is a great actress and she can do anything. And she also speaks to the new generations, but also she could speak to the old generations. She is a massive star, in my opinion, that is going to, you know, show in this movie that she's capable of anything.
She has got so many roles that are recognisable to audiences as well. Did you have many conversations about making sure that Elodie was different to the version that we've seen of her on screen before?
Yes, you know, and in fact, you know, the idea of she's a young, beautiful woman and turns into a fighter, we needed to share that in a different way. And I thought that the best way to do that is showing the intensity of the transformation. That's why, you know, there is a big section in the movie, which is the survival, you know, through the caves, that you see little by little how she's getting rid of layers from her past. You're seeing how she's literally physically changing in this. She cuts her hair, she's sweating, she's bleeding. And I think that is something that really important for the story to really convey that, this is a story about real transformation, a kind of shaking transformation that is going to affect you as a viewer. And Millie, I think, you know, embraced that idea, and she did it in, you know, in a very honest way, which I always is a pleasure to do that with, you know, with an actress, you know.
Your background before this, you've worked in thrillers and horrors before, and I think that this film has quite a lot of darkness to it. I was just wondering how you navigated working out how far to push into that scariness, but also kind of holding it back for kind of a wider audience.
You have to be faithful with the story, you know? And I think the level of darkness that Damsel contains is related with the fact that every single classic tale, every single fantasy tale contains a level of darkness. Because if you're going to tell the story about a transformation, you assume as an audience member that probably the protagonist is going to walk through darkness, because that's the only way to transform yourself. You have to walk into a very uncomfortable place in order to become, you know, a new person, you know. And it's a matter of, you know, being faithful with that, you know. Every single dark scene, if every single horror scene is containing that and it's, you know, serving that purpose, I get the impression that the darkness is the one that you can show to the audience. It's the one that the audience is going to allow you to see in some ways, because it's connected profoundly with the story.
And I was reading that the writer, Dan Mazzi, said that Alien was a big inspiration for him when writing the film. And I was just wondering, kind of coming from it from a directing point of view, did you draw on that at all, or were there any other influences that you drew on?
Alien is one of my favorite movies, for sure. And it's there, you know, the shadow of Alien, it's some kind of protecting guidance, you know, for every filmmaker, you know. But I would say that specifically for Damsel, because I was so keen to show a more mysterious suspense layer on that. And that it, funny enough, I would say that Hitchcock is kind of an influence for me, you know, even for this movie, because the way that Elodie, for example, is kind of discovering the places and how the camera is tracking her point of view, it is kind of an honor to that kind of filmmaking style that Hitchcock did, you know. So I really love old classic movies, and there was, to me, especially for this one, it's something that I would say it's kind of inspiration.
And you've also spoken a lot about how this is a kind of coming of age story following Elodie. But is it one that you would like want to explore this world a bit further in another film? Or are you thinking that this is just a singular film for you?
I mean, I would be so happy to do a sequel, you know, for Damsel. But obviously we have to wait to see what the audience think and how they react with the movie. But it's true, this, the universe of Damsel is really open, especially because, you know, the new configuration of the family at the story with this new member, it invites you, you know, to think about more adventures with them. So definitely if that happens, I would be so happy to.
You worked with Millie on this as an executive producer as well. Did she kind of bring a lot to the story in terms of kind of her own experience and stuff through that?
That's why I think she was the best possible actress to play this movie, you know, because she's been growing up doing all these works that she did in the past. And the audience in some ways has been witnessing, you know, how she's becoming a woman. And that's why I got the impression that that personal experience is in the movie as well. It's printed in every single shot that we did together, you know. She is a woman now, an independent woman, and that's something that we need, that flavor. We need that for Elodie, for our princess. And I think it's great that you can feel and breathe that on her when you see her in this movie.
So that was Juan Carlos Fresnadillo on Damsel. James, what did you think of this film?
I mean, look, if I was 12, it would be fine. You know, it's aimed at that audience, I think. I don't think it was smart enough to work on those kind of multiple levels that you hope will draw in younger viewers and you know, someone of our age, basically, or my age. Sorry, I'm a lot older than you, so I'm not claiming you're
not that far.
But I don't know. I have a certain problem with these kind of, well, heavily CG kind of movies. Obviously, it's a film about a dragon in the sort of fantasy realm. There's going to be a ton of CG. It's funny that this casts Robin Wright, and I thought she was the highlight for me in the film. She plays Prince Henry's mother, and she's not a stepmother, but she's certainly wicked, and I enjoyed her performance in it. And of course, that kind of makes you think back to something like The Princess Bride, which is obviously a classic, sort of fantasy, sort of fairy tale kind of riff. And obviously that was, you know, what's that, like 1987 or something, and that was all filmed for real. You know, they would have filmed in landscapes and things. And then you kind of look at this and think, it's all been done on a soundstage. None of it feels real or tactile. And I had the same problem. It was funny. This is really slightly off topic, but I was watching an episode of One Day. There's a sequence where they're in Paris, and like they're kind of on, you know, some bridge in Paris. And I was looking at it going, do you think they actually went to Paris? Because none of it looked, it looked like a sort of very clean version of Paris for a start. And maybe that's what they were trying to achieve in, you know, a slightly romantic fairy tale version of Paris. But I was like, I'm not sure if they filmed any of this in Paris. It was probably just done with a, you know, green screen backdrop or something like that. Or something even more sophisticated now. And I got the same vibe from this. Not that it's supposed to feel real, because it is a fantasy story, but it just, yeah, there was nothing really to hold on to for me. Well, obviously the pairing of Ray Winston and Angela Bassett as the Millie Bobby Brown character's parents, that's one of the weirder pairings I think I've ever seen in a movie. Yeah, although it was kind of good to see Winston again. He hasn't been around too much recently. I always enjoy him, but I'm not sure if he was perfectly suited to this. To be fair, when it starts off, it's this kind of like total fairy tale type story. She's going to marry the prince, and it all looks, and I'm thinking, oh God, what is this? This is going to be very unsuitable for me. Then she gets kind of, I think it's fairly well known, isn't it, that she gets kind of sacrificed effectively. So we can talk about that. So she gets sacrificed, winds up in this kind of cavernous system with this dragon, and obviously has to use her wits to survive. So at that point, it turned around, and I'm thinking, actually, this is quite interesting now. It's flipped on its head, but it didn't, to me, it just didn't really sustain it. I wasn't that interested after a while. There were some good special effects. There's a moment where she's kind of trapped down there, and then there's this fire is kind of racing through the cavern, and she just about frees herself and just about avoids the, you know, being toasted alive. That was quite well done, but, you know, largely it didn't really do it for me.
I kind of come from a similar place really on this, in that I came to it with fairly low expectations, knowing that it's been sort of embargoed right up until extremely close to its release. So that meaning we can't, you know, you can't run reviews before then, which always slightly will set my alarm bells going before I've even watched a film. So then I kind of went in with managed expectations. And again, similar to you, perhaps thinking this isn't entirely aimed at me. I ended up thinking it was perfectly fine, but I just had a lot of the same sort of reservations as you. in the sense that I'm very much like, yeah, when things just get too digital and pixelated, which is how I felt with a lot of the fire and a lot of the a lot of those kind of effects. There's some environments feel like they're on at least a kind of, like you say, a kind of soundstage set, but any of the sort of wider world feels very much like CGI, and that they're not actually, you know, in one of these kind of countries. It just feels very much like it was all green screened in after the fact.
It strikes me, it's like a sort of, I'm not picking on Netflix, it's obviously a Netflix film, but it's a streamer thing now, that they're bashing out content, and obviously it's a hell of a lot easier to put a bunch of actors on a soundstage than fly them out to wherever, Budapest or something, or wherever you might get some sort of similar landscapes. And I get it, I understand why they do it, and probably younger viewers won't even care, really, because they're interested in the story between, you know, Millie Bobby Brown's character and the dragon. And but I don't know, there's something about that just doesn't sit right with me, but perhaps that's because we grew up in that age of things where digital only really came in, you know, with little bits here and there, and now it's the whole worlds are being created. And like you said, with fire is one thing I don't think they've quite nailed yet. A lot of the time you can just tell it's not real. Fire is very difficult to work with for real, because obviously it's very dangerous and everything, and probably very expensive as well. And you have to have stunt people and safety people and everything. So it's probably a hell of a lot easier to do it digitally. But it just doesn't feel right to me.
I sort of throughout, I was never really bored throughout. I was never kind of like thinking, oh, what am I doing here? Like, you know, willing it to end. But I was never entirely kind of gripped and never entirely felt that kind of, you know, the tension you get in the best moments of like Jurassic Park or whatever. In terms of, there's this sort of like cat and mouse element where for obviously large parts she's in this sort of cave, all these different winding kind of passages in there, and they're being stalked by this dragon. But never truly felt like massively tense, although, you know, I kind of found it sort of watchable throughout, but never like massively gripped. Like you say, obviously Robin Wright, it does in a good, like, I agree that she was one of the sort of stronger elements and she's kind of having fun, but it does remind you of The Princess Bride, which is obviously such a superior sort of fantasy. And like you were saying about certain films works on those different levels, you know, for the older and younger viewers. So that in a way, you know, it doesn't live up to something like that. Another thing which I just wasn't sure about personally, and this just could be me, but is the dragon talks in this as well, and voiced by sort of Iranian American actress Shohreh Aghdashloo, who has got a great voice for this kind of thing, you know, it must be said. But something about that just made it feel a bit silly to me, almost like the fact this dragon was talking. It took kind of a bit of the element of threat away, I suppose, made it feel like it was skewing younger as well. And I guess when you're used to the sort of how fearsome the dragons can seem in Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, this might tide you over a bit if you're sort of, you know, hanging on for House of the Dragon season 2 this summer. But I think there's times in those shows where the dragons just feel genuinely scary, and you genuinely think, oh, I just would not want to be in the same kind of, you know, environment as one of those. Whereas I didn't feel quite the same level of kind of, you know, intensity of threat here.
Well, I think that kind of sums it up. It is aimed at younger viewers, and perhaps that is why the dragon talks. I actually didn't mind the talking dragon, strangely enough. I mean, there are, we won't go into them, but there are obviously reasons, let's say, that Millie's character sort of does communicate with the dragon. And, you know, there's plot, let's say, that comes from the fact the dragon can talk. We learn things. So that didn't bother me as much, strangely. And you're right, the actress, I thought, did a really, really good job as well. So that wasn't something that bothered me as much as, you know, the issues I had, you know, elsewhere. I'm curious what you think about Millie Bobby Brown, though, because obviously she was magnificent in Stranger Things. And I enjoyed Enola Holmes that she did. Most of the other things I've seen, I don't think she's quite found something that's good enough for her talents, if that makes sense. I mean, the Godzilla film, for example, she did, I don't think was one of the best ones of that MonsterVerse series. And yeah, I just feel like she's waiting for a good role. I mean, I think she handles this well enough, but it's just, there's not much substance to the role.
No, I agree with that. Yeah, it's almost more like, I guess, and again, thinking about the audience it's aimed at, thinking about that sort of Stranger Things audience that will kind of be there for Netflix as well. There was something I found kind of fun about just watching her kind of survive these different scenarios. I thought she sort of handled herself quite well throughout it, really. And it's, and again, that it kind of plays into the overall kind of silliness of it, and the not taking it too seriously. But she's obviously very resourceful down there, and, you know, kind of pulls various things together. along the way. And I sort of thought there's something fun about watching her do that. But yeah, it's not like a character for the ages. And I suppose it's tough because Eleven was just such an amazing character straight out of the gate for her that it's always going to be slightly hard to live up to that. But it doesn't feel like a kind of, you know, a really memorable character that you'd, you know, expect to revisit again or that you'll remember in years to come or anything like that.
Yeah, I kind of hope she gets away from the sort of fantasy genre, let's call it, and I don't know, goes and works with an indie director and just does something emotional and wrought and just really tests herself. And I'm sure she will, you know, she's still very young, so I'm sure she will. But like at the moment, I feel like, as you said, Stranger Things was such a high to start on in terms of her career that it's pretty hard to top that at the moment. But I'm confident she will down the line.
And I was just going to quit another comparison. I was just going to quickly make so. Is it made me think a bit of Ready or Not, the radio silence horror film from a few years back. I think it was 2019, that film, and it starred Samara Weaving. And that was much kind of funnier, fresher, adult skewed, obviously. But just this reminded me of almost like a fantasy twist on that, just with the idea of this young woman marrying into a family and then being kind of sacrificed in the name of the family curse. And there were just a couple of parallels I noticed for that as well.
That is a good parallel. I'd never thought. I would never. I was kind of thinking, as you said, Ready or Not, how on earth are you going to link this one? I thought, oh, yeah, it's quite the sacrifice. Good one.
If you are interested to catch that, that is Damsel, and that's streaming on Netflix now. And now it's time for a very different story about women defying social conventions.
This is unbelievable. What year was this?
1971, Mexico City. A tournament of unprecedented scale, hidden for over 50 years.
La Copa Mundial Femenina.
110,000 personnes.
Mamma mia.
C'est impressionnant.
It was euphoric.
Goal! Goal!
Little did we know what was to come.
This is Copa 71. James, can you introduce this documentary for us, please?
This is a documentary about the, I suppose, unknown Women's World Cup that took place in Mexico 1971. So that's actually a year after the Men's World Cup had been in Mexico. It's really, you know, interviews with a number of players looking back on this experience. The interesting thing about it is that FIFA, the, you know, football governing body, completely they wouldn't recognize this World Cup at all as and still don't as an official World Cup, which is sort of shocking. I mean, right at the end of the film, you know, you get a few of those kind of credits that come up that tell you a few bits of info, including that women's football is currently the world's fastest growing sport. And you know, we've seen recent successes for the Lionesses and so forth, and then you sort of think it's absolutely shocking that FIFA still don't recognize it and didn't back then. And what happened to some of these teams afterwards? You know, they came out, they played this tournament, and then they kind of went home to sort of silence, basically. I mean, you know, and sort of, which is completely shameful. So yeah, it's a fascinating look at this kind of lost World Cup, really. And of course, there's lots of footage of the actual games. I mean, in some ways, I don't know how you felt about this, but I thought it was quite a conventionally made film. I didn't find it that interesting as a piece of filmmaking, but the story behind it is obviously, like I just said, is absolutely fascinating and something I knew nothing about. You know, I'm a football fan. I would have thought I might have heard about this, but hadn't. So from that point of view, it was great. The, you know, there's obviously interviews with various players, including players from England. You know, it's all very talking heads as the way it's shot. The footage is interesting, but, you know, it's just a lot of match footage, really. I was kind of less interested in who won the tournament, if that makes any sense, than, you know, the bits that I've just mentioned, the fact that FIFA sort of failed to recognise it, for example, and what happened to the players after when they came back home. So, you know, I was sort of mixed on it as a film, but it is undeniably a fascinating story.
Yeah, I feel similar in that, like, yeah, in terms of as a documentary, it doesn't feel like the most sort of intensely rigorous or anything like that. But yeah, it's a sort of a fascinating story. And what I particularly liked about it as well was I really liked the kind of the characters. And again, we sort of spoke about Origin possibly working as like a documentary miniseries before. I could have almost seen this working as a miniseries and sort of perhaps drilling down onto the individual teams and some of the individual players a bit more. because those were some of the things I really liked, like hearing some of the players' backgrounds and how they got into football and what they faced, and seeing some of the awkward old questions they were asked in interviews. Yeah, and then almost as well, like perhaps I'd have liked, I suppose that, you know, the story almost stopped there, because you know, that's the kind of the whole point of the film, that this story of this went away after the this cup happened, and then it sort of was lost to history, which is obviously one of the main points of the documentary. And we start off seeing a couple of like contemporary female players talking about how they've never heard of this before, yeah, and then the kind of the shock that they were just were completely unaware of this. But yeah, but then in some ways I almost wanted a bit more of like the fallout afterwards as well. Perhaps I could have done with a bit more of that, and seeing, you know, and the dream ended there for some people as well. So that was kind of interesting, I thought. But then, yeah, I found, again, I was kind of engaged by it. Like, I'm not the biggest football person, like sort of unlike you. And I will watch kind of World Cup type matches when it's a nice kind of little, neat little tournament, you know, that I can just get invested in for a short space of time and then move on. And so I kind of like that aspect of it, that, you know, it is a small little tournament, really. And you get a little sense of that, you know, of the teams kind of, you know, building towards the final. Obviously, there's a bit more emphasis on the England team. Yeah, so like I said, yeah, interesting documentary. Wasn't completely blown away by it, but very interesting story, really sort of likable characters in it, you know, and just really like that kind of entertaining, crowd-pleasing, easy-to-watch kind of documentary for me.
I watched it at home, but it'd be interesting to watch it on the big screen. I did, funnily enough, when I went to see Perfect Days over the weekend, they ran a trailer for 71 beforehand, and of course then the footage comes alive a lot more when you're seeing it, you know, it's in the match footage I'm talking about, when you're seeing it on the big screen. Obviously I only saw a couple of minutes worth for the trailer, but it was much more overwhelming and engaging. So yeah, I would say go and see it. If you're going to go and see it, obviously make sure you see it on the big screen, because you'll benefit from that, from the sort of enjoyment of the match footage. And I should add, it's co-directed by James Erskine, who he's kind of carved out a career making sports movies. He did The Battle of the Sexes, which is the tennis documentary, which I think was then, I suppose that was the basis for the film with, was it Emma Stone?
Emma Stone and Steve Carell.
Yeah, and I think he did From the Ashes, A Cricket Story. So, you know, he's well-versed in telling sports stories. So, you know, this is competently put together, absolutely. Just wasn't as compelling or emotional, perhaps, as I guess I'd hoped it would be.
It's interesting because it's distributed by Dogworth as well. And I find that pretty much everything they put out is at the very least interesting. Like, I find you can't go too far wrong with their stuff. But on the kind of milder side of enjoyment, this one. But I did enjoy it. It's kind of not very long either as well. It's not. It's kind of a nice 90 minutes, so worth checking out, I'd say, if not one to absolutely change your life. It's just found it very, very enjoyable, easy to watch, and yeah, really sort of like the characters, and it does shine a light on this very interesting story, because they were seemingly just capitalizing on the infrastructure from the 1970 men's competition, but then they had like these absolutely huge crowds there, and so it was just sort of fascinating to see that even all the way back then, like, women's football was drawing these massive numbers of people to come and watch. And in a way, that's kind of, you know, that's just inspiring in itself, really.
Yeah, I mean, it does show, we've, you know, now when you look at the women's game now, and as I was saying earlier, it's this fastest growing sport in the world, you know, progress has been made, thank God. But yeah, these women that were in this tournament, they were almost sacrificed on some level. I mean, it's, we do see interviews with some of the players, some of the more modern contemporary players, let's say, and they talk about, well, these women came first. They were the trailblazers, and yet never really got their due. So this film does try and do that, try and rectify that and give them their due. So, you know, that's definitely to its credit.
So if you fancy seeing that, that is COPA 71, which is in cinemas now. And finally, we're going to be sort of continuing on Pixar's run of re-releases in cinemas. We have this delightful existential buddy movie.
Is this heaven?
No, it's the great before.
This is where new souls get their personalities, quirks, and interests before they go to Earth.
Meet 22.
I don't want to go to Earth.
Stop fighting this.
I don't want to.
Hey, look, I already know everything about Earth, and I don't want anything to do with it.
You're missing out on the joys of life, like pizza. I can't smell. We can't taste either.
All that stuff is in your body.
No smell, no taste.
Or touch. See?
Okay, I get it.
That's Soul, which is a Pixar animation from 2020. This was one, James, that was a victim of the pandemic, films being sort of pushed, pulled, sent straight to streaming. And this is one of a few recent Pixar films that's getting re-releases that ended up going straight to Disney Plus and not getting any sort of theatrical. So they're finally kind of, you know, getting an opportunity to be seen on the big screen. Because, yeah, this was the first one, I think, of the Pixar, those Pixar films that went straight to streaming after having a London Film Festival premiere, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that is correct, because I remember actually seeing it. You know, I was fortunate enough to get to see it on the big screen. I love this film so much, and I was completely crushed, well, on behalf of the filmmakers, let's say, that it never got its due in the cinemas, because it's tailor-made for big screen entertainment. It's really nice that they are re-releasing it to give people a chance who maybe have only seen it on Disney Plus, and it's like, you know, please go and see it in its full glory, because it fully deserves it.
And it's obviously directed by Pete Docter, who's also now the chief creative officer of Pixar. And it's co-directed by Kemp Powers, who also worked on the recent Spider-Verse sequel. I feel like with Pete Docter's films, he just kind of doesn't miss, really. Like his Pixar films have been Monsters, Inc., Up, Inside Out, and Soul. So all his films really have been kind of the top tier of Pixar's output. And I'm just a massive Pixar fan anyway, as it is. Yeah, this was one, you know, is comparable on some levels to Inside Out, because we're going into this kind of imagining this sort of internal world and personifying it, you know, and bringing that kind of anthropomorphizing these, you know, like internal kind of feelings and concepts. And this really, I would say, just kind of pushes the limit. And that's my one. I wouldn't even really say it's like a massive reservation of mine, but I wouldn't say it's a film that's hugely for children, really, in the sense that, you know, there's cute characters, it's easy to watch, there's funny moments, but this really feels like it's aimed at people at a certain point in their life, thinking about what they've achieved. And there's like so much going on. I found that when I first saw it, just couldn't stop thinking about it afterwards, really, because there's so much to think about. And to kind of recap the plot in basic terms for anyone who sort of hasn't seen it at this point, the main character is called Joe, voiced by Jamie Foxx. And he's kind of like a music teacher who sort of dreams of being like a, you know, a full-time jazz musician. And then he kind of gets his chance to sort of play with this famous jazz musician. And then basically he kind of dies on the way, you know, dies in an accident. Then he ends up in this place like the Great Beyond.
He avoids the Great Beyond.
And goes to the Great Before, that's it. Yeah. And where these kind of souls are sort of, you know, getting ready for life on Earth. And so we sort of follow him there, and then he kind of befriends this other soul who's there, voiced by Tina Fey. And she kind of, you know, like doesn't want to go down to Earth and kind of, you know, live there. And so it sort of kind of follows those two. There's obviously a bit of, you know, back and forth between the different worlds. And it's just sort of amazingly inventive kind of visually. Just the look of it, the look of the soul world, the kind of the weird conceptual stuff you get there. Then it's got this kind of amazing soundtrack as well. You've got sort of Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross doing the score, which has kind of really different kind of sides to it. And then you also have John Batista, who's recently obviously had a documentary about him as well. I love the kind of song he does for this, the main song that I've heard a lot in the car on Disney playlists when driving with the kids. Yeah, there's sort of so much going on here. I actually haven't watched this with my kids yet, because it's one that I...
Maybe just, when they're like 19 or something, then, you know, then they might sort of start grasping its concept. No, I think you're completely right. It's one that skews more adult than some of the other Pixar movies. I mean, but to me, it feels like the natural successor to Inside Out on some level, whereas that was the sort of looking at the inner workings of a human being and looking at emotions and sort of dramatizing those emotions. And this time, well, it is looking at, as they call it, the Great Beyond. It's looking at what happens to us when we die, you know, or at least it's positing what happens to us when we die. And that is such an ambitious thing to do, let's say, in an adult narrative film, let's say a non-animated film. That would be an ambitious thing, but to sort of do it in a film that adults and children can understand and relate to. You know, we were talking about films operating on different levels earlier, like, you know, The Princess Bride. And this is just a film that's operating on so many levels. For me, it's very hard with Pixar, because it's a bit like, you know, picking your favorite Christopher Nolan film. I mean, they're all good. Where do you rank them? But for me, this is right up there near the top, personally. But, you know, I know a lot of people love Inside Out, for example. And obviously you go back to Toy Story 3 is a complete masterpiece, for example. But Yeah, I just think because of the ambition of this, and obviously I saw it when I was an adult, so I guess I tapped into its more complex themes, I suppose. But yeah, for me, this is right up there. I mean, I think it's Doctor's best film, but you know, I can understand people going for whatever, Monsters, Inc. Or Inside Out, you know, or Up is obviously also an absolutely beautiful film as well.
Yeah, it's a big shout because I love all these films. I think all these films are 5 stars. There's not much in it for me, but I'd possibly even say I'd rank this at the bottom of his films, but then that's not an insult at all, really, in comparison to those others. But yeah, this one does have some very moving moments as well. And again, just so much like to think about philosophically about, you know, kind of satisfaction with life and where you are and where real enjoyment comes from, what makes experiences meaningful. There's a hell of a lot to sort of come away and mull on philosophically after this. So.
Do you think you will take your kids to see a big screen version of it? Well, you got the chance?
Yeah, the big screen is tempting, to be honest. And again, like, I mean, I've often said this with like a lot of kids' films that I think, oh, this will go over kids' heads, but then it just doesn't. It's just me being a bit sort of patronizing. And they either get it or they just enjoy the kind of cute characters and funny scenarios and don't worry too much about the bigger picture until you revisit it as an adult.
If I had time, I think it might be one that I would revisit because, as I say, I did enjoy it so much when I saw it and feel very lucky that I got to see it on the big screen, given not many people did. So, yeah, I heartily recommend anyone who hasn't seen it on the big screen or indeed hasn't seen the film at all to definitely take this chance and see it.
So that is Soul, which is getting another limited re-release in cinemas now. So what would your film of the week be, James, from this lineup?
Well, it would have to be Soul. I feel a bit bad to pick an old film.
Yeah.
So let's avoid that and say Origin for me.
Yeah, it's quite close between Origin and Copa 71 for me because they obviously work on just very different levels. But yeah, probably Origin would nudge it for me in terms of the film that I came away thinking about more and sort of stuck in my head that bit longer. But Copa 71 also did find that very enjoyable as well. So we're approaching the end of the podcast now, but if you want more Total Film goodness, check out the new issue of the magazine, which is out now, or head over to gamesradar.com/Total Film. And if you enjoy this podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and rate it on your podcast app of choice to help others seek us out. And remember, you can always contact us on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. And before we go, just time for a quick question. Who is your favourite movie dragon?
Well, I was never really a Game of Thrones fan, so I can't really pick Game of Thrones, believe it or not. So I'm going to go for Draco, the Sean Connery voice dragon in Dragonheart.
I haven't actually seen that for so many years. And
I'm
almost
not sure how it stands up.
Well, exactly.
But, you know, you can't argue with Sean Connery voicing a dragon, really.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of can't beat him as a voice for that. And I have exceptionally fond memories of sort of seeing it in the cinema. So in some ways, it's one I don't really want to revisit just in case. It does hold up very poorly. And I remember the visual effects being really good as well to my sort of young eyes at the time, but maybe that would look a bit ropey if I saw it now. And then it's tricky for me because I do really like Game of Thrones in terms of how they're realized and like I was saying earlier, how kind of scary they are. They'd be sort of high on the list for me. I do have a big soft spot for Pete's Dragon, the David Lowry remake. And that does something very different with dragons, obviously making him big and furry and cute. But I actually do really like that film. And that's one I've kind of gone back to a few times since. And for me, is easily the best of the live action Disney remakes. Just obviously does something very different with it. Very sort of, you know, old fashioned in that sense. But I do actually really, really highly rate that. So I'm going to put Elliot down as my favourite movie dragon. So that's all from us this week. So thank you for listening. And until next week, goodbye.
Bye.
Anybody want a peanut? Yeah!